Create Your Own Life, Episode 177.
You're listening to the Create Your Own Life podcast, the show to help you create life on your terms. 3 days a week, Jeremy Ryan Slate interviews the most successful people in business and in life to help you create the life you want to create. Welcome to Life Creation Nation.
This episode is sponsored by Slate Media Productions. This is the new company that my wife and I have started. It is a done-for-you podcast solution, meaning if you are the busy business owner that does not have time to do anything but wants a podcast, wants all the PR associated with it, that's what we do. We get you in publications, we get your show out there, and we do absolutely everything for you. This is a turnkey solution. You can check it out over at www.slatemediaproductions.com. This episode is sponsored by Audible. If you're like me and you're a podcast listener, which if you're listening to this show, you most likely are, then you listen to a lot of audiobooks. So if you head over to jeremyryanslate.com/book, you can get your free audiobook from Audible. So be sure to check that out. Hey, what's up, Life Creation Nation? Jeremy here, and I'm actually really excited for this episode because it's a little bit different than what we've had in the past. A couple of years ago when I was teaching high school, one of the videos I showed my sociology class was this video about something called the warrior gene. And the guy featured in it, along with Henry Rollins, was a guy named Randy Hetrick. And he was actually the guy that created TRX, one of the biggest fitness companies out there. And interestingly enough, when I started the show, I was like, you know, I'd really like to interview Randy and find out more about what he's doing. So I reached out. He was super into the idea. And that was this episode. We got to dig into TRX. I asked him a little bit about the whole warrior gene thing just because it was interesting to me. I hope you guys find it interesting as well. So I'm really excited for this one. And before we jump into it, I just want to remind you guys that if you haven't checked out the Facebook group, it's over at jeremyryanslate.com/CYOL. And that's how you can get in and join some like-minded people. Without further ado, let's get into our interview with Randy Hetrick. So I'm really excited for today's guest on the Create Your Own Life podcast, a guy that I was actually introduced to through a documentary, I believe it was the Discovery Channel, about the warrior gene, and then I started looking more into his business. It was actually a huge business called TRX. So I'm excited to have Randy Hetrick on the show.
Nice to be with you today.
Awesome. Well, Randy, I want to kind of get a little bit into like what it was like growing up for you, because I know you ended up in the military, but was there something earlier in life that made you decide you wanted to be an entrepreneur?
Well, not really. I mean, I had always, you know, I grew up and my stepdad was a serial entrepreneur. So I had sort of seen the pluses and the minuses, right, of that lifestyle. And I did find it interesting. I think really where I got kind of more focused on it was during my SEAL career, ironically, I really got to love working in these sort of small, flat, you know, organizational structure teams that took on big challenges and you know, had to figure out a way to succeed no matter what. And that fits a pretty good bill, right, for entrepreneurs. And just, I think I have a generally pretty high tolerance in retrospect, looking back, for one, pain, and two, risk, but managed not blind risk, you know, and we can talk more about that if you want. And that, those sort of set me up, you know, I think as a decent candidate, to become an entrepreneur.
Absolutely. Well, before we get into the bigger end of your military service, I actually mentioned that Discovery Channel documentary in the beginning. Can we talk a little bit about what it was like finding out that you had a certain gene called the warrior gene?
Well, I mean, I didn't know what the heck it meant, but as the show, you know, developed and I paid a little more attention to it, it essentially, I think, is statistically, there's some evidence that certain kinds of cats are pre-wired for certain kinds of vocations and avocations. And there's a gene specifically, and I don't remember what the exact name of the gene is, that makes someone relatively more or less predisposed to risky behaviors. And, you know, lo and behold, I got it. So, you know, I don't know really what that means in life. I think that as the show revealed, there were a lot of people who, like Henry Rollins, who thought for sure he had it, having been, you know, this gnarly punk rocker and then kind of an adventure-focused guy. Turns out he didn't. There were some fighters that didn't, some bikers that didn't, but then some Buddhist monks that did. So, who really knows? I know that it more or less fit with the life that I've led, but I don't know what it means beyond that. It was fun doing the show, though, with Henry. He's a cool cat.
That's definitely something I recommend that the audience check out, because it was just really cool to kind of get that insight into, you know, what made you different and everything. And I guess the military for you is a big part of your background. I know you've been out for a while now, but how do you think your military experience has kind of formed you as an entrepreneur? Because I've interviewed a few different former military guys now, from Mark Devine, Ryan Mickler, and they talk about how their background kind of made them more predisposed to be an entrepreneur. Do you think that kind of had an effect for you?
Well, I mean, I think that I learned in the military what I liked and didn't like. I wasn't a huge fan of bureaucracy, right? That was something that I learned, you know, as you may know, that SEAL teams are a small piece of the much larger Navy and Special Operations Command, administratively up through the Navy. And the Navy is a big bureaucracy, right? Really the biggest one in the country. And I didn't love those elements of the job when I would have to operate in that environment nearly as much as I did the SEAL team elements, where I was working with these small, you know, really hot teams, if you want to use a business term to describe what the average operational unit behaves like in the SEAL teams. And I loved that. And I loved, you know, all the autonomy. I mean, I was, you know, I got out of BUDS when I was 23 years old, the SEAL selection course. And by the time that I was, you know, 24, I was traveling around the world with a group of 20 guys, you know, on the other side of the earth doing some really cool and interesting missions. And that got me hooked on that sort of autonomous nature of entrepreneurship, and a, you know, very high level of accountability, obviously, and significant risk. But if you believe in yourself and your team and what you're doing, then it can be a great fit.
Was that difficult for you to come back to the regular community and have to kind of, I guess, focus to what was different than the military for you?
You mean once I got out of the military?
Yeah.
There were a lot of different lessons that I learned, you know, in the first few years out of the military. Probably the biggest was just the contrast between, you know, the grass is always greener, right? Or it always seems greener till you jump over the fence and you land, you're like, shit, there's a bunch of brown grass here too. I think the thing that I missed the most and probably took for granted the most during my service in the SEAL teams was, number one, just how incredibly capable the guys that were surrounding me every day were, how resourceful they were. And then really the biggest piece may have been how accountable, because that's something that I noticed when I jumped back across into the civilian world. Accountability is not something that is generally found in surplus. It's often found to be in short supply. And that was a new, that was a hard adjustment for me, because I had never dealt with guys who, what I had dealt with was a bunch of guys who would burn themselves to the ground trying to deliver what they promised. And, you know, you find that on the outside, that's relatively more rare. So that was a pretty big adjustment for me.
How did you kind of handle that? Because I know with your company, you've had to work with a number of people. But how did you kind of, I guess, handle what you saw was a problem with the civilian world?
Well, I mean, hey, I'm still working on the answer to that question. You know, I think that we try to screen for folks that have, you know, integrity and accountability. And then third, close third, but third, specific skill sets that are, you know, optimal for the position. But, you know, you can have all the skills in the world, and if you don't have a basic level of integrity and a high comfort level with accountability, you're going to be marginally useful no matter how many skills, other, you know, relevant skills you have. So we try to find folks, and it means a lot of times that we end up hiring a lot of vets. Usually at TRX, there's about 20% of the workforce at any given time, sometimes a little less, occasionally a little more, but usually around 20% of the workforce that has served, because those folks just come steeped in that culture of accountability.
So let's kind of just transition a little bit to TRX as a company. I know once you came out of the military, you ended up going to business school. And where did the whole idea of TRX come from? Because I know if our audience haven't done this type of training, it is like one of the coolest things you can do to really challenge yourself in some very different ways.
Well, it was original. I mean, truly the original invention and necessity. And I didn't create the suspension trainer to start a business, right? I never even thought of this as a business until I was at business school, which was 5 years after I had created the first harness. You know, we were deploying during the middle of the 90s. We were doing a ton of deployments overseas. Back in, you know, in the United States, we had a world-class training facility because SEALs and other special ops cats basically have to function at the level of a professional athlete, you know, physically. And obviously the game has pretty high stakes. So, you know, they invest heavily in training and the know-how and the equipment to do it back in the States. But when we deploy and around the middle of the 90s, you know, probably before most of your listeners were giving a hoot about politics, to say the least, you know, President Clinton was big on he'd figured out that there was a cool way that you could, it was deterrence through deployment. So, you know, if there was something bad going on in the world, as often as not, we would forward deploy into the AO and then wait. And sometimes, you know, an operation would happen. I would say most often back then it wouldn't. But what would happen is the bad guys that were doing whatever nefarious thing you wanted to stop would hear, hey, there's big white guys with a lot of guns down in this warehouse, right? We got to get out of here. And they would disappear. And so it was pretty effective, actually. And during that time, we had no way to train. So the first harness I had come up with as literally using a jiu-jitsu belt that I had accidentally stuffed in my gear bag as I was deploying, and tried to create what has today become known as functional training, right? Create a training movement that mirrored a movement that I needed to perform in my job. In this case, it was for the underway shipboarding mission, climbing a caving ladder. So if you think about, you know, the body mechanic of climbing a caving ladder, I wanted to come up with a way to train the climbing muscles when we didn't have any gear and no pull-up bars. And so I came up with this crazy harness that would allow you to lean back, you know, attach it to a door or any other sturdy object, lean back against gravity and lift your body, you know, as the resistive force. And that was the genesis of what later became TRX.
How much weight could that early belt, I guess, hold? Was that something you had to really be concerned about? Did you just start looking for other materials, you know, why you were in this area?
Well, we would always deploy with kit boxes of extra gear, right? Because I mean, one little known fact, right? With 10 feet of nylon webbing, you know, some rigger's tape and some 550 cord, you can conquer the world. So we would always have boxes of this stuff. And I found this this jiu-jitsu belt in my bag and thought, oh, that's not going to be super useful on this op. Tied a knot in the end of it, threw it over a door, and then leaned back. And those are husky belts, so there was no problem there. But what the problem was is I realized, hey, this movement that I'm doing one-sided, I wonder if I could tie the knot in the middle and then be doing more conventional stuff, right? Rows, curls, maybe even flies. And so when I did that, I found out, all right, well, now it's too short, right? So I went over and got some webbing, tied it in the middle, tied a knot in the end of it, and you basically had, for those of your listeners who understand TRX, you essentially had the Cro-Magnon predecessor, to what we have today, the upside down Y, right? And that then lent itself to when we redeployed back to the States. I mean, a couple things happened. One, SEALs are all pretty resourceful cats, and particularly when it comes to training, they're all, you know, very opinionated and very pretty well informed as consumers. So guys started saying, like, well, wait a minute, what if you did this? What if you did this? And maybe keep up loops in the bottom of it and put your feet through it. And so I got back and had a buddy out in the parachute rigger shop who was a Navy parachute rigger, basically a seamstress in uniform, right, who liked to drink beer. And so he would make these for guys in the squadron. He'd call me and say, you know, hey, boss, Jones wants me to make one of your gizmos. And And so Jones would give him a case of beer, and he'd stitch up, you know, a harness for him. And that was really where it lived within that unit. And for, you know, 4 or 5 years before I left the SEAL teams and went back to business school.
That sounds like something with that many guys using it before you had actually productized it. You'd have to kind of worry about, I guess, losing the idea a little bit.
Well, you got to remember the community that you're talking about, right? There was an awful lot of sensitive stuff going on behind those gates. And so guys tended not to, you know, go and it's really insular community to start with. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I don't think anybody else initially envisioned this as a business either. It was just kind of this, you know, we created stuff all the time that would fit a need. And this just happened to be a piece of training gear versus a piece of tactical gear. And so that was really how it got viewed. And it wasn't actually until, you know, when I decided to go back to business school, because I was promoting out of the field. I never really wanted to, as I mentioned, I never wanted to be a Navy bureaucrat. I had, my wife was pregnant, and I wanted to be the first one of my friends to actually, you know, get to spend time with my kid and know my kid. And it just seemed like the right time to, if I was ever going to pivot and recreate, you know, my next chapter, that was the moment to do it. So I applied to one business school, which was Stanford, not really thinking I was going to get in, but kind of as a bargain with my wife. Lo and behold, I got in. And so that was the first moment when somebody said to me, one of my master chiefs at the time said, "Oh, boss, you know, you're going to business school. You got to take the gizmo and turn it into a multi-million-dollar business." And I just sort of chuckled. I was like, "Yeah, right." You know, he was onto something.
And how did that work for you, I guess, once you finished business school? Was it a project in school, or was it something that kind of came later on, or what?
Yeah, I had no intention of going into, I did think a lot about entrepreneurship, but I really thought that I would probably do something. You know, I came from with a pretty significant leadership experience, having led big units. I figured I would go get my MBA from Stanford and probably go to work for a larger, more established company. But I was open to the idea of a startup, a well-funded startup. I never really intended to do a bootstrap startup. Mm-hmm. But when I got to Stanford, the interesting thing happened. I had a buddy who had been a tailback on the football team who knew the coaches and made a couple of introductions and ended up getting me permission to go and train in the athlete training center, right? Because I was this old commando, old being 36, right?
Ancient.
But by that point, I was totally hooked on my straps. So I would go out into this world-class training facility, you know, the Stanford Athletic Center, and hook up my straps to a squat rack and just crush these workouts. And over the course of the first year that I was there, every one of the coaches that, you know, would pass through and kind of look, come over and say, "All right, you got to tell me about this thing." And 10 minutes later, they'd be telling me why it would be great for their athlete. And their athlete, you know, spanned everything from a 90-pound female tennis player to the 250-pound lineman. Mm-hmm. And that was when, you know, you're sort of at business school thinking about business, connect the dots between those two cohorts that I just mentioned, and you're like, wow, that's a pretty big swath of prospective customers. And so I used the summer between first and second year. Everybody else was going out and getting these posh, McKinsey internships paying 10 grand a month. I instead went into my garage, bought a $50 sewing, used 1940s sewing machine from, you know, the used sewing machine vendor, and started prototyping the strap into something more, you know, gentrified, if you will.
Right.
And I also started doing some research on supply chains. I reconnected with some of my buddies in the SWAT team in Hong Kong and found out who made their gear. And then I turned the second year at Stanford into an incubator. Every single project for every class that I did was around this concept for this company. So it took me about, you know, a year after graduation to have some of the little pesky things that you don't learn about at Stanford Business School, like, you know, how to do an angel round, how to get pesky little things like insurance and, you know, rent a pathetic little warehouse to, you know, to hold inventory and all that stuff. And then I really launched in kind of 2005.
And how tough did you find it early on? Because I know, I think a lot of newer entrepreneurs don't quite understand this. You know, being, you were for the most part self-funded, correct? You know, how tough was that?
That was, I mean, that was one of the harder parts, right? Early on, and you got to think back on the time. I mean, the bubble, the last air in the dot-com bubble burst was whooshing out of the valley, you know, here in Northern California. And so I found myself out trying to pitch sometimes to the wrong audiences. I was pitching to venture capitalists and private equity guys who, number one, were not going to invest in this kind of crazy fitness gizmo. And number two, you know, they were really all panicked because their investment portfolios were, you know, going down the toilet. So that was not a great time to be raising money. And I ended up pivoting and deciding to do a couple of rounds. You know, I took my whole life savings, which astonishingly, you know, after 14 years in the SEAL teams, I had about 50 grand, you know, to my name saved up, put it all into the early startup costs to get something. Then once I had prototypes, you know, to actually show to people, then I went and did a very small initial round from angels. I didn't take any family money because at the time, if that whole thing cratered, I had to have some place to go.
Right.
Christmas.
Right.
And, but I took, you know, I took money from friends who did angel investing and who sort of said, hey, if I'm going to put my money on any jockey, you know, this guy's as good as any that I can find, because at least they knew that I would burn myself to the ground trying to, you know, generate a return for them, whether I was successful or not, you know, who knew at the time. But that's how I proceeded. I did kind of the classic, you know, sort of bootstrap, stair step fundraising where you raise a little bit, have a couple of objectives that are on your near-term plan. You go hit those objectives, and then you get a disproportionate rise in valuation because people go, shit, I actually did something they said they were going to do. You know, so you get this disproportionate rise in valuation, and then you raise a little more and repeat, right? Each time, a couple of objectives, go knock those down with the limited funding that you raised, get another jump in valuation, raise a little more. And, you know, the downside of that is you're pretty much raising money all the time. The upside is that you can, it gives you an opportunity to create some real value in the company before you raise a big chunk of money and get diluted, you know, excessively.
And then how did you kind of get this out into the fitness community? Because that can be really difficult, being that there's so many people in the community. You know, it could be really difficult to be that person that kind of rises where you really get noticed.
Yeah, that's probably the second most difficult thing, right? Mm-hmm. First is you got to get started. And taking something from concept to market ready is challenging if you don't have, you know, money.
Right.
And that's, people always ask me, hey, what's your best piece of advice to entrepreneurs? Without a close second, it is this: come from a rich family, right? Because if you can arrange that, everything else is much easier. Unfortunately, I couldn't pull that off, so I had to take the hard road. But the, you know, raising money and getting people to believe in the concept early on is really challenging. You have nothing. Then the next big challenge is the one that you're pointing to now, which is, okay, so now you got something, but how do you get anybody to care about it who isn't part of your internal group, right? Your family and friends or early, you know, investors. The way that we did it, and it was coincidental, not deliberate. You know, a friend of mine called me and said, hey, you know, there's this trainer trade show down here in San Diego. You ought to come down to this thing. And I had been making some early sales, you know, going around to a combination of specialty fitness retail, like little retailers, and trying to sell straps to them, which took a lot of time for not a lot of return. And that wasn't going to scale all that well. And then I had been hitting gyms, and I would go in with a backpack full of straps, talk the fitness manager into letting me have 30 minutes of their next in service with their training team. And I would go in, you know, and in 30 minutes I would have to win them or lose them. And then this buddy said, you know, you're going to gyms. Why don't you come to this trade show? So I did. I went down to that, and we sold out of everything we had the first day we were there. And that was really interesting, right? Because there I had a bunch of users who are really, number one, really familiar with exercise and you know, function, what we today call functional movement, right? Basic body movement mechanics. And this was something that they'd never seen because it didn't exist. I brought the first strap to market ever. And so, you know, it was challenging to get them to understand how it worked, right? Because it kind of works in the opposite of what you're used to. Mm-hmm. If you have weights, the weight moves, the body stays still. If you have a cable, you know, or a band, it moves and the body stays still. With the suspension trainer, the straps stay still and the body moves around them, right? And so that was a little bit of a challenge. But what I realized early on was we could provide a tool to trainers that did some things that nothing else out there did. And if I then could embed our tool in their toolkit and make them successful with it, they'd become two really important things. Number one, they were an immediate, you know, customer, and they would swipe their credit card. And early on, cash is king, man. So, you know, payment terms, instant payment terms are a really valuable thing. And then number two, having bought the product, they then became a missionary brand ambassador because they would turn around and expose, you know, between 1 and 300 clients a year to the suspension trainer.
Well, and I think so, that also gives them the ability to make themselves unique from other trainers out there as well.
Yeah, well, we offered a lot of value to mm-hmm. them, right, in that respect. And then very quickly we realized, hey, if we create a course that really gives them quickly a lot of knowledge about how to use this unique tool in a whole bunch of different ways to deliver their clients and their athletes and their patients results, then it makes them look brilliant, right? It's essentially, you know, it's like the magic wand, and you've just, you know, I've given you the magic and the wand, you're a magician now.
Right.
And people will pay for good magic, right? And that's essentially how we looked at it. And so very quickly we started to attract this army of training pros of all kinds, personal trainers, physical therapists, chiropractors, group fit instructors. And those people took us deeper into their communities. It really ended up being a B2B play because we would sell to training pros and by extension, the facilities in which they worked. And so that for the first 10 years of the company, that's really where we focused our energies.
Was that kind of different than what you expected when you initially launched it?
It was. Yeah. I originally thought that we would sell my original hypothesis and a lot of the work that we had done with the focus groups at Stanford lent itself toward this idea that, hey, in the SEAL teams, how did we use this the most when we were deployed away, right? So I had this idea that this was going to be this really unique travel fitness tool. Mm-hmm. Hence, the original name of the company was Travel Fit is what we originally launched with. Very quickly, the market told me something else, right? The market told me that, yeah, you might be that eventually for people, but the only way you get those people is through brick and mortar retail. Brick and mortar retail is a really hard channel for an undercapitalized startup. Meanwhile, I got these trainers that are telling me that I'm for them. And so that was one of those early pivot points where you could dogmatically drive forward with your plan and fail, mm-hmm. or you listen to what your customers are telling you, pivot deftly, and, you know, succeed. And fortunately, you know, SEAL teams are famous for being nimble and being able to react quickly and morph into, you know, different strategies. And so that was a pretty natural thing for me. And I'm glad we did it that way.
And that is really kind of interesting too, because I don't know if any of our listeners have gone into some of these, you know, big box gyms now, and you actually see a lot of them have actually even chained your TRX straps to the ceiling to be able to have like better anchoring and stuff like that. And it is different than that travel idea that you had early on.
Yeah, totally. I mean, one of the challenges that we face now as we're broadening to the consumer, because we, you know, my original vision was a B2B to C brand, and now we're finally to the 2C part. And as we broaden the consumer, one of the challenges is undoing some of the success we've had in clubs, because which would have been crazy at the time that we started to think that clubs would rip out, you know, whole areas of single user cardio machines, treadmills, ellipticals, or, you know, single use selectorized plate machines, clear a whole area of that expensive gear out to put in, you know, this crazy frame, like a swing set with 20 straps hanging from it, right? Nobody's going to do that, except people have done it thousands and thousands mm-hmm. of times across the country and around the world. So now a lot of times when people see the straps, they don't associate them with a home use. They associate them with a commercial use and this big frame. And they think, well, I don't have one of those, right? And so now we have to go back and sort of take them back to where we started and say, no, guys, this is a tool that goes anywhere in your life. You may meet it in the club or in the athlete training center, but it'll go with you anywhere, you know, hotel room, your house, a park. And so it's interesting. It's just funny the way that, you know, that a brand evolves over a decade.
And in that time period, when did you like know that you actually like had made it? Like, this is something that, you know, isn't just a good idea, isn't just a great business, but that this is something viable that I can scale.
Well, I mean, in terms of, you know, knowing that I made it, I'll let you know when I get there. I have a healthy dose of, you know, paranoia that I think keeps us on our toes. But, you know, we knew when we repeated the experience with those trainers that I described at the trade show a few times, that was where I first said, all right, these guys are some skeptical dudes and gals, right? Like they're, if you can get to a training pro or a health practitioner, right, you got something, because they tend to be very conservative in new things that they want to introduce to their clients. Because, you know, the client is the goose that's laying the golden egg, and they roll out some goofy, you know, trendy thing that the client hates, and they lose the client. So it's a good bar. If you can sell to professionals, then you got a pretty good sense that, all right, our product is good. And then it's a question of how to scale it without screwing that up. And as we started to then migrate and start to see a lot of uptake into elite athletics, where, you know, a lot of personal trainers are also performance coaches, right? Mm-hmm. So they'll have, whether it's young athletes, a lot of trainers will train young athletes as well. And then some of the higher end trainers train, you know, pro athletes in the off season. And so those partners, that's how I view training pros, are my partners in this business. They started to deliver the TRX suspension trainer to their clients, and their clients get a lot of PR. So we started to see, you know, some of these marquee athletes pop up in the press hanging on our straps. And that was really when I knew, like, okay, we got something.
Wow. Like, in terms of viability, can you just give us an idea of how long it actually took you guys to be, like, I guess, comfortably profitable?
Well, profitability is a funny thing, because you can be profitable, you know, much earlier than maybe you should be profitable, right? And we could have been,
right?
I mean, the way I describe it is we could have been a profitable gnat at any point along the way, waiting to get eaten by a lizard. You know, we made a deliberate choice. I told my original angel investors, hey, it's going to be 7 years at a minimum before we're even going to have a conversation about trying to get you your return. Right. So if you're investing here, you're investing for a long haul, because we're not going to be profitable. We're going to continue to raise more money as we need to build this brand and to grab market share. So, you know, it's a hard question to answer. We could have been profitable in year one if we kept all of our expenses, you know, really, really low. The problem with that is you don't get anywhere. And along comes somebody who's already a going operation, and they see your idea, and next thing you know, they're the ones who brought it to market, right? So we made a deliberate choice not to really focus on profitability until about year 10 was when we flipped the switch and scaled back some of our long lead investments and really kind of leaned our organizational structure to the right size to generate profitable revenue growth, right? Revenue growth that yields significant profit rather than just revenue growth for the sake of revenue growth forever, because that doesn't work. At some point, you have to actually make profit, right, to stay in business.
Well, I think that's a great point, because I think a lot of newer entrepreneurs, you know, they make some money and they start taking too much money out of their business right away, and then that kind of cuts the lifespan short.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly was not one of those. So I at some level envy those guys who cash in early. You know, I worked for the first 3 years out of Stanford Business School for nothing, like pay. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I was the last guy in the organization to get paid. And even then, it was a fraction of what I would have made, you know, as a former Navy SEAL officer with a lot of leadership experience and a Stanford MBA. You can do okay, right? Unless you decide to be a bootstrap entrepreneur, in which case, you know, you get to suck it up and be the janitor in chief, as well as the chief executive. But that's, you know, that's the path I chose. And, so it was probably, I don't know, 8 years in before I started to really make a decent living in terms of cash comp. Mm-hmm. But I always believed in my equity, right? And that one day, it would all even out, and I would have made a lot of money per year, you know, in the rearview mirror. So I'm still working on that plan.
Totally. Well, I want to kind of transition a little bit to you as the entrepreneur, and, you know, look a little bit at your skill set. What would you say is the biggest skill you feel like you possess, and how did you develop that?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, I mean, first of all, I would say that SEALs in general are the kinds of guys, the way that they screen for that role is they look for guys that are really good at a lot of things, but not necessarily the best at any one thing. You know, it's sort of like the Malamute, right? It's this dog that's pretty damn fast, pretty damn strong, and can go forever through any condition. And so that turns out to, I think, be a pretty good profile for entrepreneurs, because you're never going to be the most skilled in any of the respective functions of business. I mean, if you are, then you may be screwing up, right? Because it probably means you don't have good enough people. But I would say my kind of marquee skill set is the ability to put together teams and then hold them together, you know, through really stormy weather, because you should expect that in a startup, particularly an undercapitalized startup. So I would say that's probably my, you know, my single greatest skill is the ability to find and attract good people who are willing to come into a vision that is not necessarily motivated by the best cash comp they could get anywhere, but offers a lot of upside in terms of the equity and a lifestyle that they believe in. And, you know, that's it certainly is my math skills, I can tell you that.
Well, would you say that's something that you kind of got from running other guys in the military, or was that something you possessed before?
Maybe a little of both. Because in athletics, I had usually ended up in sort of a captain role or a, you know, part of the team leadership. But I think certainly the SEAL teams and the Navy, the broader Navy experience as a naval officer, developed that in me. Because you're leading not with cash. You get guys to do things through persuasion and, you know, style and collaboration, not because you can pay them more or less. So, yeah, I would say that was probably a pretty formative period for me in terms of developing those skills.
What role did mentorship play for you in your business journey? Did you have somebody that was a mentor, or was this kind of you on your own?
No, I've had some really good ones. I had a lot of mentors, and I'm a huge believer in that. I think that you know, honestly, at this point, man, I'm getting a little long in the tooth. You know, I just turned 50 this year, and it truly is the case. I think it's true for all folks, if you're paying attention, that the more you know, the greater your appreciation for how little you actually know, right? And so the question is, well, wow, if I don't know all these important things that I need to know, where do I get that knowledge? And a lot of times you can't afford to buy it and put it into your team. So you got to go get it someplace else. And mentors are a great place to do that, because you'll find guys who are, you know, and gals who are very experienced in different areas of your business, will be happy to, you know, to share that knowledge with you. It makes them feel good. It's interesting to them. And, you know, and all you have to do is make that relationship be mutually beneficial, and you can surround yourself by great mentors. And so I certainly have done that along my own path.
What's been the best piece of advice you've received in your career?
A lot of good advice. You know, probably the most useful piece of advice applied was originally given to me by a guy that I was pitching as an angel, as a prospective angel. And it's actually ended up being more broadly applicable. And it was this. He said, you know, Randy, the thing you got to keep in mind when you're pitching your concept is you've got to deliver this big vision, right, in all its complexity, in a bite-sized morsel that in 5 minutes, right, you can give me enough information to go to one, get excited, and two, go home that night and tell my wife or my business partner about why your thing's so cool. And that was like really interesting, right? Because in 5 minutes, I've got to give you enough of a picture that not just that you can understand it, but then that you can go home and tell somebody else how cool this concept is. And that ends up being really applicable in fundraising. You got to be able to do that, because a lot of investors, you know, the first 5 minutes, they may give you an hour, but they've made their decision in the first 5 minutes. And it even becomes useful beyond fundraising when you're starting to think about how to pitch a product to the consumer. You know, you're lucky if they're going to give you 5 minutes. So that same concept of how do you simplify and distill mm-hmm. your message down to such an elementary level that it's not dumb, right? It's not dumbed down. It's just distilled down so that there's these tasty morsels that in 5 minutes I can give to you, and you can go, man, that's delicious. And I can go home and you know, tell my gal about this. And that was probably the best advice I ever got.
Well, you've actually been on the other end of that as well, on a fitness TV show in the last year or so, correct?
Yeah, I had a lot of fun last summer. Shot a TV show with Jillian Michaels and Obi Obadike that was The Search for America's Next Great Fitness Phenomenon.
Do you feel like a lot of these guys that you had speaking to you were kind of weak in this area that you felt like was good advice to you, the actual pitch?
Yeah. And I told that story, I think, a few times to the contestants on the show. Was basically, look, you've got to distill your pitch down to the level at which, you know, someone can very quickly understand it. And that means you have to be, because it also has the benefit of, in order to do that, you have to be really clear in your own head about mm-hmm. what it is that your value proposition is, how you're different, right? What your unique point of differentiation is, and why you're going to be successful. And if you can't do that, well, I need more time than that. Well, then you better go back to the drawing boards, right? Because you don't get more time than that in life. And so, yeah, that was a message that I found myself giving over and over and over to these young fitness entrepreneurs who, you know, were very excited about their product, but had a hard time, you know, explaining in any sort of cogent manner why it was going to succeed.
Well, I think that's a great piece of advice that our audience can take with them. You know, if you're listening, Life Creation Nation, it is time to get your pitch down, because if you aren't able to tell people in a very quick, succinct manner what you're trying to do, you know, it's like Randy said, then nobody's going to care, man. Maybe you think it's the greatest thing in the world, but if you can't explain it to somebody very quickly, it's over.
Yeah, it really is. And you think to yourself as you're defining it, hey, this isn't just for them, it's for me. Because if you don't know where you're going, right, you damn sure aren't going to get there.
Well, one of the biggest things we've heard from our audience is they actually like to hear when somebody successful has going on in the next 6 to 12 months with their business. What does that look like for you and TRX, Randy?
Well, the big initiative for us is, as I mentioned, you know, we've been a B2B business for the first 10 years of our existence. And we started preparing a couple of years ago to expand that and to add, not only expand our product line within the commercial fitness space, but to take the suspension trainer into some all new markets, and namely the big consumer fitness market. And that market is reached via different distribution channels, different communication channels. So it's really this brave new horizon, right, for TRX, where frankly, it feels a lot like a startup again. We know the pro business really well. The Joe business, not so much. So we retained a really great marketing agency, some guys named called Greenlight out of LA, to help us navigate this. And we have a great PR agency called the Brand Amp that's going to help us do this as well. And these two groups have some of the expertise that we don't internally to help us communicate to true end users directly without the intermediary of a training pro, right? Because it's a real luxury if you can put an expert between you and the end customer, and that expert can do your bidding. That we don't have when we go direct to consumer. So we have to do, you know, all that communication work on our own. And that's a big challenge. And so broadening the product line, going to new markets, that's what we're up to over the next 12 months.
This episode is sponsored by iBoom Media. If you are looking to get your brand out there in the right way and actually grow your social media following, these are the guys you want to talk to. Taking my Instagram following from around 1,800 to now we're around 11,700. My Facebook following from 800 to now 39,000. Wow. And my Twitter following is now closing in on 5,000. So these guys do an amazing job. And they are not just grabbing followers. They're actually finding people that interact, retweet your stuff, like your stuff, and will possibly buy your product or service. So you can check them out over at www.iboommedia.com. Well, we're about to come in for a landing, Randy. But before we do, are you ready for some rapid fire questions?
Oh, man, I don't know. It's scary, but I've been shot at before, so go.
All right. You are selected to give a commencement speech. What topic do you cover and why?
I'll go back to what I said before, integrity and accountability. You can bring those to any employer in the world. You're going to kill it.
Got it. Do you have one quote that you've leaned on through your journey?
I always seem to go back to the one. I have two on my desk, but the big one is the Henry Ford. Whether you think you can or think you can't, you're probably right. And then the other is from Lao Tzu, and I remind myself of it every day. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step.
I got to tell you, The Art of War is actually, for myself, one of those books I read yearly, because you look at it with a new perspective every year.
Yeah, so true. That's why that thing's, you know, been around for, I don't know, a couple thousand years, right?
Mm-hmm. What about for you, one book that's had a big effect on your life?
I really like, and I always refer to this when people ask me this question. There's a book by Alfred Lansing called The Endurance, and it's about Shackleton's voyage, you know, at the beginning of the opening of the 20th century to the South Pole, and just about everything that could possibly go wrong went wrong, and the most austere circumstance that you could ever imagine, by all rights, they all should have died a frozen death, but he got all his guys out. And it is really a story about endurance. And, you know, when you read it, it puts a lot of the other hardships that we face as entrepreneurs in really good perspective.
It's really funny. My wife's family actually lives in the southwest of Ireland. So about 2 weeks ago, we just got back from Dingle, and there is a bar in Dingle called the South Pole that was opened by Tom Crean, one of the guys in the Shackleton expedition. They just opened a brewery called Crean's Brewery, named after him.
That's, well, I tell you what, if your readers ever want to read a great book, that's a great one. And you just, it's another one that I could read once a year and see things that I didn't see last year.
Yeah.
So that's a great one.
This is a really tough one, but when you think of the word leadership, what person comes to mind?
man, I've had some great mentors and great leaders. I think actually, you know, guy who was one of my closest friends who I went through buds with, Admiral Tim Zemanski, just was promoted to 2-star admiral and took over command of all of Naval Special Warfare, and is just about the best leader that I've ever known. And so that guy jumps to mind for me.
Cool. Well, success is a word that's kind of thrown around a lot, but I think we all have like our own meaning attached to it. But if you got to define success for yourself, what does it mean?
Well, I think it certainly means that I've enjoyed the ride along the way. You know, some days that's easier than others. But I think that you can't always focus on the destination, because you may or may not get there. You got to enjoy the journey. And for me, that means that my team, with whom I'm, you know, on that journey with, also enjoys it. And so, you know, so that's, to me, the success is that we create a great place for people to work. We have a great vision that does, you know, really good things for others. TRX touches millions of lives a year and makes them better. And then ultimately, that provides a rewarding experience for myself and a great life for my family. That's, you know, it's probably nothing super insightful there, but it's a bit more holistic than just, you know, to get rich.
Well, Randy, I've got to say, this has been really awesome to really, you know, dig deep into where TRX came from. If our listeners want to connect with you and, you know, learn more about you and what your company's got going on, where's the best place to do that?
Well, so our website, trxtraining.com, is a great place to learn about the company. And at TRX Training is our Facebook. TRX Training is our Instagram. And then personally, randyhetrick.com is my personal website, and my social handles are the same, Randy Hetrick. So, you know, we've got some good stuff that we do on both Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, and you might even see us on Snapchat soon. So
awesome.
That's awesome. Where I send them.
Well, Randy Hetrick, thank you so much for being on the Create Your Own Life podcast today.
And if you don't have a suspension trainer, you got to go get one.
So I hope you guys enjoyed hanging out with me and Randy today. You can check him out over at randyhetrick.com or trxtraining.com. And if you want to get the show notes for this episode, it's over at jeremyryanslate.com/177. Rock on, everybody. Have an amazing weekend and go out there and create your own life.
Now go out there and create your own life. Motivation may be great, but action is better. Get it done, my friends.